It's 2 o'clock, and this is Captain Rick reporting. I'll be reading from the Wednesday, January 9th edition of the Decatur Herald and Review. The first article is entitled, Pleading Their Case. Hawk's Demise Draws Attention to Non-Insulated Power Lines by Tony Reed, Decatur. The life of Eva, the red-tailed hawk, was over in a flash. The magnificent bird of prey died December 16th, after her Decatur owner, Martin Handley, said her wing brushed the non-insulated wires of a transformer atop a wooden utility pole and the bird was fatally electrocuted. Handley is hoping some lasting good will arise, phoenix-like, from the story of his beloved hunting partner's demise. Handley wanted other falconers who used their birds to find and take small game to be mindful of the risk posed by transformers with bare wires. He plans to reach out to Ameren Illinois Electric Utility and plead the case for stepping up efforts to insulate exposed transformer wires, a move he said that will save future EVAs. Some transformer wires are insulated, and I know from what research I've done that Ameren knows it's a problem, and they have spent some money on it, said Handley, 61. But there is still a long way to go. Ameren spokeswoman Kelly Hendrickson told the Herald and Review that new transformers going up on poles today are insulated to safeguard birds and other wildlife. But she says a mass program to retrofit or replace all older models that use non-insulated wires would be a bridge too far in terms of expense. The utility has 43,700 square mile service area, festooned with 1.3 million poles and tens of thousands of transformers and 1,500 substations. She said Ameren Illinois has gone the extra mile at sensitive locations where raptors were especially at risk. Hendrickson said the utility worked with federal agencies and the Illinois Department of Natural Resources in 2012 to develop an avian protection plan to safeguard birds. We actually found 150 different circuits in Illinois where raptors, basically eagles and ospreys, tend to nest, and we found 1,400 structures on those circuits, such as power poles, and we retrofitted those poles with protective equipment and other modifications. That still leaves Handley staring at a transformer with bare wires not far from his home and some of his favorite hunting grounds. He said training a bird for falconry takes years, and while the birds can never be considered pets, they form a bond with their owners that touches somewhere deep in the human psyche. It's a bond of another level, you know, something special, said Handley. A fellow Decatur falconer, Randy Teig, who is backing the call for Ameren to do what it can to insulate or replace older transformers, put the man-bird relationship this way. They are still a wild bird, and they are hunting naturally, said Teig, 56, a falconer for 10 years. But they are allowing me to participate in their wild hunt, to let me into their lives, and that is just something amazing and well worth protecting. Hendrickson said that, while not promising action in response to specific requests, falconers and others with concerns about utility equipment in a special area are welcome to discuss them with the utility. An estimated 900,000 to 14 million migratory birds are electrocuted annually on electric distribution lines in the U.S., Fish and Wildlife Service said. Perhaps the last word should go to Jack Nuzzo, the program director at Decatur's Illinois Raptor Center and a keen falconer himself. Nuzzo has been intimately involved in efforts to make power lines safer and has served as a consultant in work connected to power industry group called the Avian Power Line Interaction Committee, which has developed standards for making power lines safer for birds and other wildlife. Nuzzo also points out that federal law mandates that investor-owned utilities, such as Ameren Illinois, do what they can to provide avian-safe structures. He also pointed out that the utility has a major corporate supporter of the Raptor Center's work, and Nuzzo said the company has proven its willingness to be a good corporate citizen. He did note that electrical co-ops, which supply power in many rural areas, are not required by federal law to achieve the same avian protection standards. But Nuzzo said co-op utilities he has worked with have proven themselves willing to safeguard wildlife around their infrastructure. It makes good business sense, good wildlife sense, and it's also good customer relations, Nuzzo said. The wildlife expert said that, looking at the amount of older infrastructure out there, a program to retrofit all of it with critter safety in mind just won't fly from a cost point of view. He recalled that in the 1990s, falconers did agitate for laws mandating a retrofit fix because back then so many birds were dying in power line accidents. But people eventually realized the cost of that retrofit, if it actually happened, would have put out our power bills at $9,000 a month or something crazy, said Nuzzo. It was unrealistic. Now, with the improvements that have been made and the safeguards built into new equipment, like transformers, Nuzzo said bird electrocution deaths and injuries seen at the Raptor Center are relatively rare. He said the most common reason for raptor and other bird deaths and injuries these days is something as common as power lines, but much harder to safeguard, windows. Collisions with windows on buildings cause so much damage, it's unbelievable, Nuzzo said. People now get upset about things like wind farms, but windows have been killing birds for years, and nobody cares. Included with this article is a picture of a beautiful red-tailed hawk sitting on a man's leathered left hand. The caption reads, "Falconer Randy Tague holds one of his birds of prey, a red-tailed hawk named Ember, at his home in Decatur. Hadley, who recently lost a bird in December to electrocution, wants other falconers to be mindful of the risk posed by transformers with bare wires." And, having been to the Illinois Raptor Center myself recently to attend Raptor Camp, I met Jock Nuzzo, and we talked about various things that can be done along these lines. And I myself held, on my left hand, a red-tailed hawk, a screech owl, a peregrine falcon, and a bald eagle. We really need to protect these magnificent wild creatures. The next article is about health. Medical marketing reaches $30 billion. Critics, ads drive more tests than may be necessary. By Lindsay Tanner of the Associated Press. Ads for prescription drugs appeared 5 million times in just 1 year, capping a recent surge in the U.S. medical market, a new analysis found. The advertisements for various medicines showed up on TV, newspapers, online sites, and elsewhere in 2016. Their numbers soared over 20 years as part of broad health industry efforts to promote drugs, devices, labs, tests, and even hospitals. The research has estimated that medical marketing reached $30 billion in 2016, up from $18 billion in 1997. Spending on consumer-focused ads climbed faster, but marketing to doctors and other health professionals still grabbed the high share, with the bulk of it paying for free drug samples. Marketing drives more treatments, more testing than patients don't always need, said Dr. Stephen Woolishin at Dartmouth College, health policy expert. Woolishin wrote the report with his wife, Dr. Lisa Schwartz, both longtime critics of overdiagnosis and overtreatment. She died in November. They analyze marketing data from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, Medicare, and other federal and state agencies, private companies, and medical research. The report covers 1997, when the FDA eased rules for TV ads, through 2016. Although some types of spending waxed and waned during those years, Woolishin said the upward trend is concerning and suggests consumers need to be increasingly skeptical about marketing claims. The report was published Tuesday in the Journal of the American Medical Association. All marketing spending was adjusted to 2016 dollars. A journal editorial notes that medical marketing has survived legal challenges and needs no apologist. It's also helped make patients more informed consumers, and it's up to doctors to help their patients and understand product claims, although some physicians need more education themselves about deceptive marketing, the editorial suggests. Spending on direct-to-consumer marketing climbed fastest, from $2 billion, or 12% of total marketing, to almost $10 billion and one-third overall spending. Only the U.S. and New Zealand allow prescription drug advertising, which in the U.S. went from just over $1 billion and 79,000 ads to $6 billion and 5 million ads in 2016. The category also includes TV ads and other marketing for hospitals, which skyrocketed to almost $3 billion. Spending on disease awareness ads more than doubled to $430 million spent on 401 campaigns. Woolishin said this was among the most disturbing trends. Drug names aren't mentioned, but manufacturers often use these to sell diseases that can be treated by costly new drugs, he said. Marketing aimed at doctors, nurses, and other health professionals went from $16 billion to $20 billion, about two-thirds of all spending. About $12 billion went for free drug samples, although that spending has dropped recently. Spending on personal pitches from drug company sales reps was mostly unchanged at $5 billion after an early increase. The government's Open Payments website lists doctors with financial ties to drug and medical device makers, and in 2022, it will expand to include physician assistants and nurses with advanced training. Federal law says advertising must be truthful, not deceptive, and backed by scientific evidence. The FDA oversees prescription drug and device advertising. The Federal Trade Commission regulates over-the-counter products. The analysis suggested that the surge in medical marketing has led to spotty oversight by both agencies. It notes that while company submissions more than doubled over the two decades, reaching nearly 100,000, FDA violation letters for misleading drug marketing dropped from 156 to 11. That could mean drug companies are doing a better job of self-policing, but Woolishin said it's more likely regulators are overwhelmed by the volume and can't keep up. Still, the report notes an increase in FDA violation letters about marketing of unapproved genetic tests, and off-label or deceptive marketing practices have resulted in $11 billion in fines and 103 settlements between drug companies and federal and state regulators since 1997. The American Medical Association in 2015 supported banning direct-to-consumer ads for prescription drugs and says doctors should not accept medical industry payments or gifts intended to influence prescribing habits. The vast majority of physicians prescribe drugs and treatments they believe are in the best interest of their patients, the AMA said in response to the news analysis. Holly Campbell, spokeswoman for the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, defended industry marketing practices, and said direct to consumer ads can make patients better informed about their health and treatment options. She said these ads also increase awareness of the benefits and risks of new medicines and encourage appropriate use of medicines. The next article is about state government. Madigan Lauds Lawmakers for Epic Struggle by John O'Connor, AP political writer. Springfield. The Illinois House wrapped up its two-year session Tuesday with legislation to help the incoming governor, with House Speaker Michael Madigan praising lawmakers for persevering in an epic struggle over state spending with outgoing Governor Bruce Rauner. The Democratic House majority endorsed measures to allow Governor-elect J.B. Pritzker to offer higher salaries to his cabinet and to replace a problematic Illinois Tollway Board. The legislation moved to the Senate for action before the 101st General Assembly convenes today. The two-year session saw Madigan, who's held the gavel for all but 2 years since 1983, become the longest-serving state House speaker in U.S. history during a critical period in which he proved his mettle. The Republican Rauner's insistence on approval of his conservative agenda in exchange for an annual budget deal has left Illinois without a spending plan for 2 years. Madigan lured enough Republicans in July 2017 to approve an income tax increase to fund an annual budget over Rauner's vetoes, ending what Madigan on Tuesday called an epic struggle. You deserve credit for what you do day in and day out, but you know that from time to time, the issues become more significant on one day than they were on a prior day, or they may be on a future day, Madigan said. And that's exactly what happened in the struggle between the legislature and the executive department. Rauner, who relinquishes the office to Pritzker on Monday, previewed the end-of-term report he must present to the legislature. He highlighted his improvement in landmark 2017 legislation to make school funding fairer, cutting red tape for small businesses, improving Medicaid, and winning a U.S. Supreme Court case he initiated that prohibits government unions from collecting fair share administrative fees from non-union members. But he said the report will also encourage the business-friendly changes he came into office trumpeting and which prompted the budget showdown. When it was suggested that voters had repudiated the agenda by choosing the Democratic Pritzker in November, Rauner said, "Change is hard. The folks that created the massive problems in our state certainly are resistant to change," Rauner said. "That doesn't mean that our recommendations are somehow wrong or flawed. It means it's going to take time to communicate with the voters and get the changes done." Pritzker, who wasn't part of the proceedings, was the main beneficiary of Tuesday's action. The House voted 68-37 to change state law and increase annual pay for the Director of Prisons, the Transportation Secretary, and the directors of other agencies governing human services, health care, the environment, and more. Pritzker said Illinois salaries for agency directors and assistant directors aren't competitive. The legislation would increase the highest salaries from $150,000 to $172,500. Critics complained that non-union middle managers have dealt with salary freezes for 15 or more years. They said the state can't afford higher pay when there's a $130 billion hole in what the state owes to its pension systems. By a vote of 100-6, the House approved allowing Pritzker to abolish the terms of the Tollway Board that oversees 294 miles of tolls tolled interstate highway in northern Illinois because of questionable spending. Opponents argued that replacing the board would delay the tollway's construction work scheduled for this spring. Republican Representative Gene Ives called the legislation a political ploy because a majority of the board members' terms will expire by May. Men Face Murder Charges by Kevin Barlow, Bloomington. The two men accused of murder in the December 5th shooting death of a Bloomington man had their initial appearances Tuesday in McLean County Circuit Court. Anthony Grampas, 18, and Tyjon Bruce, 20, appeared before Judge Sarah Duffy on charges of murder, home invasion with a firearm, armed robbery, robbery, and residential burglary. Each face 8 counts, including 4 murder charges. They remain in Macon County Jail in lieu of each posting $500,035. The two were arrested by the U.S. Marshals Service on Monday in Decatur on warrants charging them the death of Egerton Dover, 20, of Bloomington. Authorities have released no further details on the case and did not address a possible motive. The suspects are due for arraignment January 25th. McLean County State's Attorney Don Knapp was in the courtroom when the two appeared via a video link from the jail. "This is an active investigation, and we have no further comment at this time," he said. Police were called about 4:41 a.m. December 5th to 816 West Jefferson Street in Bloomington after a report that someone had been shot. Dover later was pronounced dead at the scene by McLean County Coroner Kathy Yoder. "He died of multiple gunshot wounds," police said. It is unknown who fired weapons or if any weapons were recovered. Meeting to focus on recycling campus. Study session to be held at 5:30 p.m. January 15th by Ryan Boyles, Decatur. A special meeting of the Macon County Board is set for next Tuesday to delve further into whether the board should move forward with a multi-million recycling campus on the west side of Decatur. Board Chairman Kevin Greenfield confirmed Tuesday afternoon the board is set to meet at 5:30 p.m. Tuesday, January 15th, at their boardroom on the fifth floor of the Macon County office building in downtown Decatur. Greenfield said the meeting was asked for by the county's Environmental Management Director, Lori Ramos, and will mostly be a study session to learn about the project and which direction to take it. No vote on the project is expected to occur. The $7.5 million project was first brought up last year with the plan to build a 109-acre substantiality campus. Initial plans include a drive-through recycling center, offices for the county's Environmental Management Department, and a possible compost center, small solar farm, and community gardens. The then Democratic-led Macon County Board voted in October to rezone the site in the 1100 block of North Wichols Road for the project by a 13-5 vote, with 5 Republicans voting against it and 3 other Republicans absent. With Republicans now holding a 12-9 majority on the board after the November election, the fate of the project has become uncertain, as Greenfield and others had previously expressed concern over its estimated cost. Rasmus said Tuesday her goal for the special meeting is to lay on the table what the proposal is for board members, saying it has not changed much from what has previously been reported. The department has looked at several different options for the site moving forward, Rasmus said, which could include shrinking or doing away with the composting site for the time being. Not much could be done to reduce the cost of the recycling facility itself, due to construction materials, with interest in recycling events like last week's pop-up recycling event, which had over 200 people drop off electronics. Rasmus said the prospective recycling facility would allow for regular hours for drop-offs and move away from event-style recycling. She repeated something officials like former board chairman Jay Dunn had said in the past, that construction costs would be covered through a 20-year bond issued by the Decatur Public Building Commission, which manages county facilities. That loan would be paid off using an existing tax levy and with no increase to existing tax rates. The county board recently finished making payments on the bond for its courthouse complex and office building. Officials have said paying off that debt would result in a property tax bill savings of $12 per year for the owner of a $75,000 home. If another bond is not issued to pay for the facility, the recycling facility, that savings would be $18 per year for the owner of a $75,000 home. Rasmus said, along with information, she hopes a special meeting nudges the board to schedule a vote on the matter. Greenfield reiterated that, in better financial times, he would probably support such a project. But with the county's population decline and shrinking sales tax base, leading to the potential for steep budget cuts and layoffs, he said he was not sure whether he could see the Republicans moving forward on the campus at this time. I don't see any light at the end of the tunnel, he said. Claire's owner takes a break. Restaurant to close through February and maybe longer, by Danette Beckett, Decatur. Due to the closures and recent health inspections, Mike Pound, the owner of Claire's restaurant, has decided to close the establishment until the end of February. The last day of operation for the restaurant, located at 2502 East William Street, was December 30th. During the next 2 months, Pound said he will reevaluate the business and circumstances to decide whether to reopen the restaurant. January was the first part, and the first part of February, our slow part of the year, he said. Pound said he is not ready to open the restaurant again. I'm tired of the politics, he said, but I haven't ruled out reopening. During 2018, Claire's was closed twice due to low health inspection scores. In November, the restaurant received a score of 46 out of 100. It was previously closed in April after receiving a score of 53 out of 100. A score of 85 or greater is required to open again. The restaurant reopened about a week after both closures. Claire's restaurant employs 17 staff members. We are so happy to be a part of Decatur for over 20 years. We really appreciate our customers, Pound said. But it's not fair to my customers and my staff by getting closed down. For those seeking Claire's gift certificate reimbursement, Pound recommends customers mail them to 2502 East William Street, Decatur, Illinois, 62521. Greenup woman dies in one car crash, Toledo. A Greenup woman died from injuries she suffered in a single vehicle crash near Toledo in Cumberland County on Monday night, according to the Illinois State Police. Julie A. Croy, 44, was pronounced dead at Carl Foundation Hospital in Urbana, where she was taken after the crash, the state police said in a news release. Croy was driving east on Illinois 121 about 7:30 p.m., about a mile east of Toledo, police said, when her car went off the right side of the road. The initial investigation showed the vehicle hit a farm field entrance, becoming airborne, and landed front in a ditch before skidding to a stop, police said. and I'll be right back after the break.